Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Graham Virgo, and I'm the director of the Cambridge Private Law Centre. And I'm delighted to welcome you all to the 24 Old Buildings Annual Lecture. First of all, I want to thank 24 Old Buildings for continuing to sponsor the lecture and the work of the Cambridge Private Law Centre. We are very grateful. I have said to our speaker, I am not going to say much by way of introduction because she is known to many of us well, but I'm delighted that the 2026 lecturer is Professor Susan Bright, Professor of Land Law from the University of Oxford, Harvey McGregor Fellow, and Tang Lecturer and Tutor in Law at New College. I am going to let Sue talk about her topic. We are all really interested in hearing what you're going to say about new housing, old rules. Can land law keep up? Please welcome Professor Bright.
Thank you very much. It's a great honour to have been asked to give this lecture. I'd like to thank Graham Virgo for the invitation and for 24 Old Buildings for supporting the event. As you can see from the title, and you've just heard, I'm going to be talking about new housing and old rules. If you read the blurb about the lecture, you'll realise that I'm also going to talk about the Law of Covenants. And unfortunately, the Law of Covenants has a bit of a reputation for being very dull and rather hard. I'm hoping to show you that it's not quite so dull, but I can't do much about it being rather hard. So when I was thinking about the lecture, I went for a walk and I took some photos. And these photos set the scene for what I'm going to be talking about when I talk about new housing. It may well be that some of you live on one of these kind of estates that I'm going to be talking about. And so these photos are typical of modern housing estates. So you can see roads, play areas, seating and signage. And in the past, these amenities were nearly always adopted, that is, looked after by a statutory body, such as the local authority. And the costs were met through local taxes. But that's not the case for the estates in my photos. Instead, the amenities on these estates are looked after by private companies, and the costs are passed on to homeowners through estate charges. And this is now the new norm. A report from the Competition and Markets Authority estimates that around 80% of housing built by the 11 largest house builders in recent years has taken this form. So in this lecture, I'm going to call these private estates, just for shorthand. And by that, I mean that at least some of the amenities on the estates that I'm talking about have not been adopted, but are going to be looked after by private companies and paid for by homeowners. Some of these estates are relatively small, but some have the size and complexity of small towns. So not only will there be residential housing, but there are offices, retail units, leisure facilities, and schools. And looking after these estates is not straightforward. So the photo in the top left of the slide is from an estate that has not only got play areas and private roads, but it's also got a large expanse of woodland that you can see, a community meeting space, and a water system which includes a weir and a sluice gate. And the estate charge covers looking after all of these. The second photo is from a different estate. Modern housing estates tend to have special ecological and environmental features, as well as complex drainage systems for water runoff. And these are required through the planning process. So on this estate, it's got various habitat requirements, which you can see in the photo. And again, looking after these can be costly. So therefore, we need two key things for these estates to work. First, the shared amenities must be looked after and paid for. The looking after is done by a management company who I call Manco, and the cost is recovered through an estate management charge which homeowners pay. Secondly, on these estates, there's often a certain aesthetic which the developer wants to be maintained. And so to preserve this requires control over the appearance of homes and how they can be used. That's why I've called it keeping the vibe. Now, armed with some knowledge of land law, you will realise that achieving this may not be straightforward. The goals can, of course, be achieved through suitable contractual arrangements made between Manco and homeowner number one. But what happens when homeowner number one sells the house to homeowner number two? First, both Manco's responsibility to look after and homeowner one's liability to pay money are positive covenants. And as Lord Templeman famously observed in Roland Stevens in 1994, every student of real property law learns at an early stage that positive covenants affecting freehold land do not run with the land and are enforceable only against the original covenantor. Secondly, even the vibe covenants may present challenges. Some are positive covenants, for example, to keep the front garden tidy or to maintain fences, and so they face the same Ronan Stevens obstacle. The majority, though, are negative covenants, for example, to only use as a dwelling house, not to build extensions without obtaining consent, and so on. And in equity, these may be enforceable against successors under the principles stemming from the case of Tulcombe Moxey in 1848. But this applies only if the covenant benefits or protects land of the covenantee, and if the benefiting land is identifiable. And this may not be the case if Manco is the covenantee and doesn't own any land. So I'm going to be explaining in this lecture how, therefore, these estates work, given those obstacles. The law of covenants remains largely as it developed in the 19th century, and this is so even though there have been many calls for change. So we'll start with the 1965 report of the Wilberforce Committee. This recommended new legislation, and it considered that positive covenants should run with the land in a similar way to negative covenants. It referred specifically to the unsatisfactory outcomes on housing estates with shared amenities, and it noted that there's a public interest in the communal facilities being properly maintained. The focus of that report, though, was on covenants between neighbours and also problems with blocks of flats. The second batch of papers are the Law Commission working papers, and these looked at rent charges. They assumed that the Wilberforce Committee proposals would be implemented, and therefore the rent charge suggestions they made were seen as a stopgap. But as we shall see, rent charges are still being used. The 1971 working paper again recommended that positive and negative covenants should run with the land, provided they meet the touch and concern condition. The 1984 report recommended the introduction of both a land obligation and a development obligation. By the time of the 2011 report, we had common hold as a legal possibility. The Law Commission didn't therefore give any further consideration to the development obligation, as it assumed that common hold would do the job. Now, as you may know, with common hold, shared facilities are owned and managed through a common hold association. Units are owned on a freehold basis, and unit owners have a share in the common hold association. But the assumption that common hold would take off and would provide a solution for interdependent units was misplaced. Even though common hold has been possible since 2004, only a tiny number of common hold sites have been established. So notwithstanding all of these calls for change in the law of covenants, nothing has changed. So in this lecture, I'm going to be firstly talking a bit more about private estates and some of the emerging and problematic issues that there are on them, with a brief mention of current government concerns. I've already mentioned the old rules on covenants, but as Lord Justice Lindley observed in the case of Osterbury and Corporation of Oldham in 1885, there are ways and means known to conveyancers by which burdens can be made to run. In that case, the burden that he was considering was a payment obligation to pay towards road repairs. But as we shall see, there are various workarounds that can enable non-payment covenants also to run. And to explain these ways and means, I'm going to refer to a case study that I conducted a few years ago. At the time of the study, there was a campaign going against what was called fleecehold. And that's a clever play on the ideas of leasehold, freehold, and being fleeced. The campaign's storyline focused on what was said to be toxic covenants. And the phrase fleecehold caught on. You can now see it being used not only in social media, but also in mainstream media outlets. You can see it being referred to in the House of Commons and in parliamentary debates. So my case study was very small, particularly because COVID lockdown arrived just as I was beginning to plan the interviews. But I did look at 80 states and I carried out detailed analysis of title deeds, land registry entries and related documents. And I also interviewed several homeowners, but it is by no means a representative study. Whenever I refer to a case study today, it will be by a pseudonym. So the next thing I'm going to do is ask whether these ways and means are satisfactory. They seem mostly to do the job, but as Leslie Turano said in the 2000 Conveyancer, it's undesirable that people need to take circuitous routes to avoid the effect of a legal rule. Bernard Rudden, in his seminal chapter on the numerous clauses, put it more strongly. He said, to resort to fictions is preposterous. I'm then going to briefly touch on the draft Common Hold and Leasehold Reform Bill, which was issued at the end of January, and ask whether Common Hold might help on these estates. And finally, I'm going to ask what ownership is like on these estates. In my case study, one interviewee who was unhappy with the legal arrangements said that she'd bought a fake freehold. So I want to ask, what did she mean by that? Does living on a private estate deliver a diminished form of ownership? So let's start by looking at the estates, just to explain a little bit more about the context. So adoption is a voluntary process. So both the developer and the relevant public body have to agree for the amenities to be adopted. And for both sides, it can be costly. For the developer, adoption normally means higher upfront costs. The infrastructure has to be built to adoption standards. So for example, private roads, like the one in the photo, often don't meet the standards required for adoption, which means it's cheaper for the developer to build the amenities. The developer may also have to provide the statutory authority with a performance bond to guarantee completion of the works and pay commuted sums to cover the costs of future maintenance over a 20 to 30 year period. For the statutory authority, adoption means taking on long-term responsibility for what are often very complex estates. And given austerity, most local authorities don't now have the capacity or will to do so. But there is growing evidence that all is not well on private estates. If you look at Hansard and you type in the word fleecehold, you'll see that there have been numerous parliamentary debates referring to some of the problems. And this slide shows us two of those problems. Firstly, homeowners complain about high costs and poor value for money. At present, homeowners can't challenge the costs that they consider to be unreasonable, but that is going to change when the provisions of the Leasehold and Freehold Reform Act of 2024 are brought into force. Secondly, the amenities are not satisfactory. Often, there are reports of unfinished roads, unsafe playgrounds taped off to prevent access, and drainage systems, which are often little more than open ditches. There are other problems. So homeowners resent paying both council tax and estate charges. And this is especially the case where the facilities are open to members of the public. So, for example, play areas are often paid for by the homeowners, but open to obviously anyone who wants to use them. And they also carry a particularly high public liability insurance cost. Site management is often embedded so that the management company, Manco, is locked in. And that means that even if homeowners are unhappy, they can't switch to new management. On some sites, Manco is run by the homeowners, the residents, and they find it burdensome because they haven't been trained in site management. This week, I don't know if anyone else is following the Common Hold Bill closely, but this week, pre-legislative scrutiny has begun on the draft Common Hold and Leasehold Reform Bill. And on Tuesday, somebody called Halima Ali gave evidence saying that private estates are unfair, exploitative, and unacceptable. And this is a picture of her I took from the Manchester Evening News. She said she was promised a park, but the park is just grassland with a slide and a small carousel. She says it's unloved and it's strewn with litter. And in the news story, she says, I don't want a management company to have control of my life. And buying a new build home was the biggest mistake of my life. It's taken a toll on me and my mental health. The government is beginning to take some steps to tackle the problems. The Leasehold and Freehold Reform Act, known as LAFRA, will make various changes when it comes into force. So it will give a right to be consulted on major costs and to challenge unreasonable costs, to appoint a new manager if the site management's failing, and there'll be greater transparency of costs. The government's also recently issued two consultation papers. The first is focused essentially on implementing the statutory provisions of LAFRA. And the second one reflects the government's preference to increase the rates of adoption so that there will be fewer of these estates. The Law Commission's also looking at managements of these sites in its 14th programme of law reform. In particular, it's exploring how residents can be given greater control. So I'm now going to turn to covenants. And I hope what I'm going to show you might be helpful, but you may find it rather unhelpful. I've tried to show diagrammatically what the legal framework typically looks like on one of these estates. And I've taken one of my case study sites that I called Ridgeway, which is a site with 600 homes on it. I am going to explain this. So it's typical for the documentation on these sites to be tripartite. And on this slide, I've underlined the developer, homeowner, and Manco. They are the parties to the title deeds. The blue shapes show the people who own legal titles. So that's the developer and the various homeowners. And it is common on these estates for Manco not to own any land. When I say it's common, this is based on what I've managed to glean. It's difficult when you're not a practitioner to be really confident with some of these things, but I'm reasonably confident with these claims. And so if we look at the covenants here, we've got the homeowner covenants to pay Manco the estate management charge. That's the green arrow. The homeowner also enters various positive and negative covenants with Manco, the developer, and as a separate covenant with the other homeowners. So these are essentially the what I call the keeping the vibe covenants. And then Manco promises the homeowner and the developer that it will look after these shared amenities on the estate. So I also interviewed some people who lived on Ridgeway, some freeholders, and they weren't happy. The problems they mentioned echoed many of those in the media stories and have been raised in Parliament and have also been mentioned in the government's recent consultations. And the next photo is a photo from, it's a newspaper report, and it's taken from the Ridgeway site, but obviously can't give you the full title of it because then that would disclose what the name of the estate was. So I'm calling this one Ridgeway. And it shows the very poor condition of the roads at Ridgeway. These roads were meant to be adopted. It may be that they have been since I interviewed the homeowners, but I interviewed them 5 years after they'd moved onto the site. So at that point, they still hadn't been adopted. And the residents were complaining about uneven and broken roads and pavements, raised manholes, concrete-filled drains, and out-of-order streetlights. One of the interviewees told me, they sold us a dream, but we're living a nightmare. So far, what I've done is I've set the context. I'm going to have to turn to some law of covenants now. And I'm going to try and show you the ways and means by which the rule, the fact that positive covenants don't run with the land are overcome. So this is a table showing the case studies that I did. On the left-hand side, that's the pseudonyms for the estates that I looked at. And then the other columns are the different techniques or workarounds used to try and make the covenants run. So we had leases, rent charges, and direct covenants. And I'm going to talk about each of these, but I thought it might be helpful to give an overview just of my thoughts on them before I sort of do a slightly deeper dive into how they work. I was going to let you just read it, but I realised that maybe some people might be a little bit challenged reading the words on that slide, so I'm just going to run you through what each one says. So the left-hand side, leases. And I'll just say a little bit more about leases now than's on there. So homeowners, people buying a home, don't want to buy a leasehold home. They want to buy a freehold. So leasehold has become very unpopular. And in 2017, the government announced that it was going to ban the sale of leasehold houses. And so since 2017, houses haven't been sold on a leasehold basis, with a few exceptions. And we've now got a legislative ban ready to go, but not actually going yet, because it's in LAFRA and Section 1 hasn't yet been brought into force. So with leases, ever since Spencer's case in 1583, leasehold covenants have been enforceable between the current landlord and the current tenant, provided they touch and concern the land. And for leases granted on or after 1st of January 1996, a very similar effect is achieved through the Landlord and Tenant Covenants Act of 1995. So you'll see the final, well, you may be able to read it anyway. The final section of the leases bit of that slide says it's unclear if Manco could enforce covenants against successor homeowners. And I'm going to explain that on the next slide in a minute, why I think that. So I'm not sure that leases really do work for everything we need to happen on these estates. If we look at rent charges, I'll again say a bit more about them later. They're really complicated. I spent far too long thinking about rent charges and I still don't think I fully understand them. So there's a rather fuzzy understanding. They've also been very unpopular, particularly because of some of the remedies for non-payment. A judge in the audience knows exactly the case I have in mind, called Robertson and Lawton. But the Commonhold and Leasehold Reform Bill, if it does get royal assent, will change this. And it's also unclear, in my mind, as to whether they do or do not allow or facilitate covenants running, apart from the payment obligation. And then we're going to come to direct covenants, which I refer here to as sneaky, and I'll explain that when I come to direct covenants, where I call them sneaky. So let me go. I'm afraid you're going to have to face some more of my diagrams. Okay, so to illustrate leases and what I think the issue might be for leases, I've taken Meadowview. It was the only one of my case study sites that had leasehold homes. And this particular lease that I looked at was entered into in 2016, which was just before the government had announced the ban on the sale of leasehold houses. So here we've got the developer sells the lease, grants the lease to the homeowner, and the homeowner enters into my VIBE covenants. But we've also got here covenants with Manco. And it is Manco that enters into the promise to look after the estate. And the homeowner promises to pay Manco the cost of looking after the estate. But the fact that there is a lease here doesn't seem to me to do enough, because what a lease does is it ensures that the covenants are enforceable between the landlord, the developer, and the homeowner. It doesn't make the covenant enforceable against successive leaseholders, because Manco is not a landlord and therefore not party, not within those covenants. But it doesn't matter on this site, because they also use the direct covenant, which we'll come to later. So I'm now going to move on to rent charges. So you'll see that three sites use the rent charge: Lakeside, Stonemead, and Coombe Way. Rent charges do some of what we want, but I'm not sure that they do everything that we need. And essentially, a rent charge is a charge that's payable out of freehold land, and the charge is not dependent upon there being a personal covenant. Rent charges have been used for centuries. Historically, they're often used as a means of financing the purchase of land. For example, a builder who couldn't pay upfront for the full land costs might buy the land partly with a capital sum and partly through an annual rent, which was called the rent charge. And to protect the rent owner, he would also covenant to build and repair the planned property. But by the 1970s, rent charges were very heavily criticised, and the Law Commission recommended that it should no longer be possible to create new rent charges. but an exception was made for estate rent charges designed to deal with the kind of issues that we're looking at on private estates. And therefore, the Rent Charges Act of 1977 was passed, which permitted the creation of new estate rent charges, which take two forms. Firstly, a variable rent charge. These are the estate management charges, service charges, effectively. Of course, the idea that a charge can run with freehold land is not new, because that's what rent charges have done for centuries. Nor was it new that they could be variable, even though in one of the Law Commission reports, some doubt was expressed about this. There is old case law that accepts that rent charges can be of a variable amount of money. So the rent charge, variable rent charge, thus delivers one of our essential aims, which is to ensure that successive homeowners have to pay the service charge. As I mentioned, there are currently some draconian remedies contained in sections 121 and 122 of the Law of Property Act, but they will hopefully soon be abolished. The second form of rent charge is called a nominal rent charge. And the purpose of this rent charge isn't the payment of the money, but it's to support covenants. So the Law Commission referred to these as covenant-supporting rent charges. And you'll see from this Law Commission quote what it is thought that they do. So the Law Commission says, not only does the liability to pay the rent charge itself run with the land affected, but so also do the positive covenants imposed to support the rent charge and maintain the security. They are directly enforceable because they happen incidentally to support the rent charge. Hence, rent charges look magical. They seem to make positive covenants run with the land. But it may not be that straightforward. The case of Haywood and Brunswick in 1881 is a case well known for saying that Tulcombe Moxey doesn't make positive covenants run, but only applies to negative covenants. But interestingly, the case itself also involved a rent charge, and there it was called an annual chief rent. And Lord Justice Lindley said that even if there is a rent charge, the covenants themselves do not run with the land. So what is going on? The explanation is, I think, that provided there is careful drafting, the rent owner, the manco in our example, can be given remedies that make it as if covenants bind successors. So the rent charge deed can reserve a power of entry linked to a breach of covenant. And this gives the rent owner a right to forfeit the land if the rent payer is in breach of a covenant. This right or remedy can be exercised even if the covenants themselves are not enforceable against a new homeowner. All that is needed is a right to re-enter if there is non-compliance with a covenant. And if this right is annexed to a rent charge, then it can be a legal interest under the Law of Property Act. In his thoughtful article on rent charges, Michael Poulsom said that this effect is penal. He said the obligation to perform positive covenants is on homeowner one. When the title is sold, homeowner two doesn't become liable on that covenant, but the penalty for breach can nevertheless be exercised against them. I've also been puzzled by many aspects of rent charges. So I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. One is, there's a very unhelpful blurring of language, which I'm sure practitioners can put me straight on, between rights of entry and rights of re-entry. In the House of Lords case of Shiloh, Spinners and Harding, Lord Wilberforce referred to the right to retake land, and he used the language of both right of entry and a right of re-entry as if they're the same thing. But when I've looked at older commentaries, they tend to be a bit more precise in their language. And they use the right of entry, not re-entry, the right of entry to refer to the right to enter the land for a limited purpose. For example, what is referred to as the perception of rents and profits, which is taking the income to pay off the arrears. The language of the right to re-enter is reserved for the right to forfeit the land. There's also a lack of clarity as to whether the rent charge device works for both negative covenants as well as positive ones. And commentators I've read are split on this. But maybe that doesn't matter, because even if the rent charge doesn't make the covenants run, it creates this illusion of magic because of the remedies available for breach. My concern is that the illusion may run even deeper, because it appears from the case studies that I've looked at that the rights that underpin this illusion are not actually always available. So we're going to have another one of my diagrams. This is Lakeside. Lakeside is one of the rent charge case studies, and it is an extremely large site. It is made up of lots of different cells. The homeowner, the rent payer, covenants to pay the nominal rent charge of £10 per annum. That's the covenant supporting rent charge. And they also covenant to pay a variable rent charge, which has got two components. One is a park-wide charge, and the other is cell-wide to reflect the particular section of the park that the property is in. And those park charges are payable to Manco, the rent owner. And because they issue out of the land, they will automatically bind not only homeowner one, but also their successors. But unless I've misread the documentation, there are some potential problems with the enforceability of the non-payment covenants against successors. So some of the covenants that homeowner has entered, my keeping the vibe comments, the covenants, some of them are positive covenants, for example, to maintain fences and to keep the garden neat and tidy. But the rent charge deed itself doesn't actually contain an express right of entry linked to non-performance of these covenants. And that's also true of the other two rent charge sites that I studied. So it appears that even though the rent charge is used, there is in fact no magical workaround for making non-payment positive covenants run. There are also lots of negative covenants at Lakeside and indeed on all of the case study sites. For example, there are covenants not to carry on a trade or business and not to keep, quotes, pigeons and doves nor any other animals other than domestic pets. But at Lakeside, these covenants are made with the developer. So these are my brown arrows. I don't know what clear the colours are, but the brown arrows are the keeping the vibe covenants. And you'll see those covenants, but not made with Manco. So I've done some land registry searches, and as far as I can tell, Manco doesn't own title to any land at Lakeside. What this means, I think, is that Manco is unable to enforce the negative covenants. It's not the covenantee, and because it doesn't own land, it doesn't get the benefit of those covenants in equity through a scheme of development or building scheme. It may be that the developer and the other homeowners can bring in action against the homeowner, but the person who we think most likely is going to want to is Manco, and they don't seem to have the right to do so. Does any of this matter? Well, maybe not. The myth of the magic and the community of interest on these estates may be enough to get homeowners to comply. In its 2011 report, the Law Commission observed that fencing covenants, unenforceable as a matter of law, are in practice managed by neighbourliness and by mythology about the significance of markings on plans. Decency and mythology can go a long way. Lakeside was the largest estate I looked at, but it's also exceptional in it's the only one that didn't also use the direct covenant. And you'll see from this slide that three of the case study sites only use the direct covenant as their workaround. So what is it? Well, the aim of the direct covenant is to try and ensure that there is always a direct contractual relationship between the current homeowner and Manco. So when homeowner one enters into the usual covenants, they also covenant not to transfer the title without requiring the transferee to enter into direct covenants with the developer of Manco. However, that technique may not work without more. As if you know the case of Thamesmead Town, this was actually an illustration of this attempt going wrong. So in Thamesmead, homeowner one promised to pay an estate charge that included the cost of general estate maintenance. The transfer to homeowner one also provided that when homeowner one disposes of the property, they would require homeowner two to enter into a similar covenant with the estate owner. In breach of this requirement, the house was sold to homeowner two without such a covenant being entered. As a result, homeowner two wasn't liable to pay towards the communal areas. And the Grenda case that I put on the slide is another example of an attempt to do this direct covenant route, but that also failed. But there is, of course, a way to make sure this doesn't fail, and that's by placing a restriction on the land register. So Section 40 of the Land Registration Act of 2002 provides that a restriction can prohibit the making of an entry until the occurrence of a specified event. And that event will be homeowner two entering into the required covenant with Manco. So that means homeowner two can't get title registered when they buy the house unless they comply with the restriction. So this route is probably the most effective one, but it does depend on the land registry being efficient. It also raises issues of principle. As the editor of the conveyancer has pointed out, this route provides an example of a restriction doing that which normal property law cannot do, that is, enabling positive freehold covenants to bind successors. Is this what restrictions were meant to be used for? Weren't they only meant to protect property rights? Using them this way both enables contractual rights to behave like property rights and also effectively reforms covenants through the back door of land registration. So we've seen that the ways and means used to get around the old rules, we don't allow positive covenants to run directly, but by using different tools from the legal toolbox, we can achieve it by indirect means. Bernard Rudden referred to this as mumbo jumbo. What I haven't yet discussed at all is Manco's obligations. The Competition and Markets Authority report is highly critical of Manco being embedded often into title deeds, making it impossible to switch to a new management company if the homeowners are unhappy. But it's clear that sometimes there can be a switching from Manco 1 to Manco 2. And I just want to make a few observations from the title deeds that I looked at. Firstly, sometimes there is a provision for residents to become members of the management company and to take control of this site. But certainly amongst those I interviewed, some had actually applied in accordance with what they were sold to become members of Manco, but they were told they couldn't. And when they asked why they couldn't, they were told it's because it's too complicated. They're not capable of running the site. It's interesting to note that the government is currently consulting on whether resident-controlled Mancos should be the default model for private estates. Some of the title deeds recognise that the identity of Manco 1 can clearly change. And the question I'm left unsure about is what happens then if Manco 1 changes to Manco 2? Because these covenants are positive covenants, and positive covenants don't run with the land. On the rent charge sites, the documentation envisages that the rent charge can be transferred to a new rent owner. So Manco 1 covenants with homeowner 1 not to transfer the rent charges except by a transfer containing a covenant by the transferee to observe and perform the various Manco covenants. But what happens if Manco simply transfers it and doesn't get Manco 2 to enter into those covenants? And if Manco 2 does enter into those covenants with Manco 1, can the homeowner enforce them? Because there's no direct contract between homeowner and Manco 2. The answer is probably that they probably can under the Contract Rights of Third Parties Act, provided the Act hasn't been excluded. On the direct covenant sites, Manco is defined to include successors, but I have no idea what that means for the covenanted promises. In practice, we hope that things simply run smoothly. Homeowners will carry on paying their bills. Mancos will carry on looking after the sites, perhaps often not very well, but at least things should hopefully stay on the road, whatever the law of covenants provides. Before I move on to my final big point about what is ownership, I just want to have a brief word about common hold. We may soon have a new kid on the block, common hold. The draft bill was issued at the end of January. But the government's focus is very much on using common hold for flats, not houses. In theory, I think common hold could work on these estates, but there's no policy nudge in that direction at all at present. And it's also unlikely, I think, the developers would choose to develop them on a common hold basis, given that they've already got these various workarounds that seem broadly to do the job. And of course, we don't even know for sure that we'll get common hold yet. Depends what happens during the parliamentary process. So this brings me to my last point I want to make, which is about ownership. I've provocatively called it mythical ownership. So a subsidiary's aim of my case study was actually to explore how ownership was understood by the freehold campaigners. One interviewee who'd bought a freehold complained it was not free from hold. Another described it as fake freehold. Another said it was more like leasehold. I had no idea that as a freeholder, I could have covenants and restrictions and charges for goodness knows what else placed on me. I've been sold a leasehold house under the guise of a freehold one. What does that mean? In law, the difference between a freehold estate and a leasehold one is temporal. Leases are for a certain period of time and freeholds are uncertain. We don't tend to talk very much about the substance or content of these estates. So with a freehold estate, what is it that the freehold owner actually has for the relevant period of time? On private estates, the freehold is sculpted by a contract. These title deeds, these TP1s, as they're called, transfer of parts, they look a lot like leases. Of course, when flats are sold as long leases, we recognise that all kinds of restrictions are necessary because of the physical and social interdependency. We can't have a flat owner on the ground floor taking down structural walls or playing a drum kit all day and night, because that will cause serious problems to the person above them. So in the leasehold contract, we have to make provision for some form of neighbourliness. But what about freeholds of houses? So a good starting point to think about this is Simon Douglas's chapter entitled The Content of a Freehold. And he explores what kind of right a freeholder has when we describe them as having a right to use the land. He refers to this as a liberty to use. Indeed, as Jim Harris explained, these liberties have the characteristic of open-endedness. And this means that the freeholder is permitted, as against persons generally, to use the land as she wishes. We also recognise there can be some limitations on this. So, for example, a homeowner has to comply with planning laws and the law of nuisance. But these limitations apply generally. That is, all freeholders are subject to these limitations. In contrast, limitations that derive from private bargains don't apply generally. An example would be where there's a restrictive covenant requiring the homeowner to use the house only as a single dwelling. Freeholders generally are not subject to this restriction, but our homeowner is. These private controls therefore limit the liberties that homeowners would otherwise have. The common law has therefore limited the number of rights, restrictions and obligations that are capable of being property rights. So Tolcombe Moxey and Rowland Stevens established the boundaries. And as Cathy Sherry puts it, we have prefabricated boxes into which parties must fit their preferences. On private estates, however, homeowners are subject to restrictions that don't apply to freeholders generally and that do not necessarily fit into the prefabricated numerous clauses box. With the aid of the direct covenant supported by the land registry restriction, contractual rights behave as if property rights. The boundaries are set not by legal principle, but by those who control the juridical field, the developers and their lawyers. They can set whatever rules they wish, subject only to the constraints of the marketplace. Does this matter? Well, we may think it's a good thing for there to be covenants that ensure a certain type of aesthetic for the estate. We may also think it's desirable for homeowners to be subject to certain positive obligations, even though they're not permitted under the general law. And whatever one thinks about the desirability of allowing amenities to be unadopted, there has at least to be an estate charge to cover the essential infrastructure. But the critical question is who decides what's appropriate. And we should remember the warning from the Lord Chancellor in Keppel and Bailey in 1834, well known to generations of law students. it must not be supposed that incidents of a novel kind can be devised and attached to property at the fancy or caprice of the owner, or, in our case, of the developer. The Lord Chancellor was at pains to point out that the problems that would come from having a free-for-all that allows all sorts of rights to behave as property rights. So this brings us to a crucial issue. Is there a point at which the removal of liberties becomes something we should be concerned about? Certainly some of my interviewees considered that the restrictions undermined ownership. One interviewee was furious about a restriction that says she couldn't change the colour of the front door or of the garage. And to quote her, she said, "The first thing I did was to get a tin of paint out and paint the garage white." On several sites, there was a prohibition on parking any commercial vehicle that could be seen from an estate road. What happens if the house is owned by a tradesperson who needs a van for their business? Kathy Sherry gives an example of a restriction found in an Australian strata title. This prevents children from playing on common property unless accompanied by an adult exercising effective control. Well, control's an interesting thing when you're talking about children in play areas, but she makes a different point. She makes the point that this would prevent teenagers from hanging out with their friends without an adult being present. Or imagine a rule, at one time a common practice in the States, that says the freehold cannot be sold to non-Caucasian families. Or a rule banning political posters in the windows. The problem is that the direct covenant route allows in all of the incidents of a novel kind that were the concern in Keppel and Bailey. And the only limit is the operation of the marketplace. So what will be the risks of a free-for-all? On these sites, there's an illusion of homeowner consent to the restrictions. The reality is that the homeowner has no effective choice. There is a housing shortage and buyers can't realistically shop around. In addition, evidence shows that there's very little consumer awareness of these terms at the time of purchase. So the risk is that we could end up with illiberal rules imposed at the whim of the scheme drafter. These rules are then permanent because they're hard baked into the title deeds. They cannot realistically be amended even as social attitudes change. In theory, it's possible to apply for the discharge or modification of restrictive covenants by using Section 84 of the Law of Property Act. But I imagine it'd be terribly difficult to try and apply that to a building scheme, and I have no idea how it would apply to a direct covenant. There's one more related question then that I want to ask, which we don't generally talk about, which is all of the reform discussion focuses on positive covenants. But I wonder whether we also need to have a conversation about negative covenants. Are we okay with the current position on negative covenants? In effect, they can nearly always be made to run with the land. The touch and concern requirement is a pretty easy threshold to cross, provided that the person seeking to enforce the covenants got a right to land within the estate. It seems that the courts take a fairly relaxed attitude to whether or not it would touch and concern. So just to wrap up, so we've seen that there's been a very rapid expansion in the number of housing estates built, which have amenities being paid for through estate charges. This includes facilities open to everyone, not just the homeowners on the estate who are paying for them. There are political questions about whether this is satisfactory. Should amenities be maintained by public authorities, or is it acceptable for them to be looked after by private mancos and paid for by homeowners? Is there sufficient control over the standard of these facilities? Are homeowners being overcharged for what they're receiving in return? These are questions that the government is currently looking at. So my focus has been more narrow. Given that the law of covenants appears to stand in the way, how have these been developed? And of course, the answer is that the ingenuity of lawyers has enabled their rapid expansion by using workarounds. The rent charge looks like it does the job, and it does in relation to the estate charge, but it may not work in relation to the other covenants. The direct covenant appears much more robust, but it does depend on the land registry getting things right. But the overall result is that burdens are imposed on homeowners at the whim of developers, and some resent this. So I suggest it's time for us to ask whether we're content to allow incidents of a novel kind to run with the land, or whether there needs to be a debate about the proper boundaries. Thank you very much for listening.